Scotch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. Today I'm going to be talking about the new films Redemption Day, The Dissident, Pieces of a Woman, The Revolution of the Daleks, and The History of Swear Words. I'll also be talking about some news, the trailer park, and the home cinema roundup featuring 12-Hour Shift. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
It's been a heck of a week out there, people. It's been a kind of a slow week when it comes to movie news and such. I do have a couple corrections. The first is, in talking about the trial of the Chicago 7, it was one of my favorite movies of the year, I mentioned that the people were arrested in violence surrounding the Republican National Convention. It was actually outside the Democratic National Convention. That's just a point of fact about the film. I just misspoke. My apologies. I had a listener contacting me through Facebook, and I'm like, oh, you're totally right. I just misspoke. That happens sometimes. I have all this genius coming out of my mouth that every now and then something slides through that's not genius. So my apologies on that. I also have a correction about the story about the death of Dawn Wells. I had said I wasn't sure if she was the last surviving member of the Gilligan's Island cast, and she wasn't. There is one person left, and that is Tina Louise. She's 86. She is still around. So my apologies to Tina Louise for forgetting that she was still with us. So Tina Louise is the last one left. And like I said, she's 86. Another piece of sad news came this week when it comes to movies and television, a little bit of television. Tanya Roberts passed away, and the details surrounding her death were so bizarre. Not what happened to her, it was how it came out in the media, because I remember seeing a report on this and it said Tanya Roberts passed away. And she was, I think she was 65, which isn't terribly old. I mean, usually when people are passing away, you know, from old age or something that's not like a, you know, a chronic condition, you know, they're usually 70s, 80s, sometimes even 90s. But Tanya Roberts is only 65. Apparently she was walking her dog around Christmas and had collapsed. And they had taken her to the hospital, and she ended up on a ventilator. I don't think she didn't have COVID or anything, but she was on a ventilator. But because of all the restrictions, whether or not you have COVID, you still aren't able to go into the hospitals and see your loved ones, in their last moments. And I think they took her off the ventilator and they thought that she was going to pass. And that's when I think they brought people in to say goodbye, or they had a session, and then the family had to leave because they couldn't hang around the whole time. And that's when they had released that information. I think it was TMZ that broke the story. But it turned out she ended up staying around for a little bit longer. So we got this sudden release the next day of, oh, Tanya Roberts didn't die. She was still alive. And then eventually she did succumb to her ailments. And so, you know, it just took a little bit longer, and that's just such a weird run of events. But, you know, Tanya Roberts, I will always remember her as a Bond girl, and she was in a bunch of stuff in the '80s, and those were my formative years. And she was the blonde haired, blue eyed, gorgeous woman that every, you know, teenage boy is going crazy for, especially in the '80s. And I remember seeing her in 1985 in A View to a Kill. And look, this is nothing against her. She was not a great actress, and that's okay. I mean, the Bond films are filled with terrible actresses. You know, you had Denise Richards is one of the worst actresses who's ever shown up in a Bond film. You know, she was in The World Is Not Enough. And, you know, there have been other less than stellar performances. I forget her name, but she played Holly Goodhead in Moonraker. That was a terrible performance in that film. And if you dig through enough of the cast list of On Her Majesty's Secret Service, there's some pretty terrible Bond girls in that movie too. But I always remember just how beautiful she was. And she kind of did a bunch of these genre pictures. You know, she was in Beastmaster, I think. She was in Sheena. And then she got a little bit of a bump a couple years later as she was getting a little older. You know, she was, you know, getting into her late 30s. So she was no longer the young ingenue. But in that 70s show, she played Donna Pinciotti's mother. And they did some fun things with it. They had one scene where they brought in a bunch of other old Bond girls to be at this party that she was at. Cause I remember they had Barbara Carrera there. It was not officially a Bond girl cause she was in Never Say Never Again. She was never in the official, Eon Productions Bond films. But I always thought that was sweet that they brought her. And I thought she actually did a really good job playing that role in that 70s show. I thought, you know, she was playing the dumb blonde, but I thought she played it really well. And there was a certain degree of acting talent that you forgot that you did not realize that she had. And of course, she was in Charlie's Angels too, but I was never a big watcher of Charlie's Angels. I don't know why, but for some reason, I never watched it when I was a kid. But anyways, it's sad to see Tanya Roberts go. One of the first big losses of 2021. Listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first movie I want to talk about is called PG, Psycho Gorman, which is not rated PG. And it comes into theaters on January 22nd.
Is that fear I smell? Your planet will be torn to pieces, and I will treat your screams as I rip.
Is this yours?
The gem of Paraxenite. Whoever wields it is able to command me.
Go over there, and wait for us to come back in the morning.
You will suffer an eternity for this.
Bye! It was nice meeting you.
It would be nicer if you were dead.
This is directed by the guy who did Manborg. I don't know if many people have seen that. That's kind of a genre-bending, somewhat of a throwback science fiction movie that plays with extreme elements, but is also kind of tongue-in-cheek. I remember the movie, and he wasn't involved in this one, but also watching this trailer, it reminded me of like Turbo Kid. Turbo Kid was a throwback to the 80s movies with the soundtrack, and it was a lot of fun, and it had this nostalgia feel to it. And this movie, it almost feels like a movie like The Gate. These kids that find a gate to hell in their backyard. This one is a more of an alien that lands, but they have control of the alien. It's sort of playing with the connective tissue of like Ernest Scared Stupid. I don't know. I'm looking forward to this one. So I'll be talking about this one in a couple weeks. The next one I want to talk about is Wrong Turn, which comes to theaters for one night only on January 26th.
I saw someone. I saw someone.
It's a story people know but don't talk about. Except in whispers. We don't bother them. And they don't bother us. But anyone who goes up there.
What is this place?
Guys!
Ooh!
They don't come back.
This is a reboot to the Wrong Turn series, which is 17 or 18 years old. I think the first one came out in 2003. The problem with this one is it looks like it's trying to weave a certain degree of politics into this, which, you know, look, I'm fine. If you want to make a movie that's a political movie, you know, I even talked about the trial of the Chicago 7. That deals with politics, but that's okay. It's a political movie. It makes sense. You know, this movie, it looks like it's trying to put it in there, but without the finesse of something like The Hunt. And I don't know. This does not look like it's going to be a very good remake. Part of what the original Wrong Turn was good. What I liked about the original Wrong Turn was it was just, it was in essence a modern slasher movie with a different location. This one looks like it's trying to be a little bit too woke, and instead of being woke, it's broke. Yeah, I just said that. Anyways, I got to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Dissident and Redemption Day. back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews. And I want to talk about one. It's actually been out in theaters for a couple weeks, and it's bubbling below the surface. It's not a very well-known title. And part of that reason is because it's a documentary and we're sort of in a lull. You know, it's not Wonder Woman or it's not Monster Hunter even. It's not even The Croods. But it's a documentary called The Dissident. This film looks at the murder of Washington Post journalist Jamal Khashoggi.
Jamal Khashoggi, prominent Saudi journalist and Washington Post columnist, has gone missing after visiting his country's consulate in Istanbul.
He was last seen entering Saudi Arabia's consulate seeking paperwork to marry his fiancée.
His fiancée saw him go in at 1 p.m. and was still waiting for him at 1 a.m.
Saudi Arabia. Now suddenly it is admitting that Khashoggi did die inside that building.
What do you know about the beast?
For somebody like me who does not pay much attention to international news, I really don't know the ins and outs of Middle Eastern politics. I will be the first to admit that. I remember when the Khashoggi murder happened, and it made news, and it was sort of this very big surprising thing. But in order for you to really understand what was going on and why he was killed, you really had to understand about politics of the Middle East, in particular of Saudi Arabia. And the fact that it took place in Turkey, in the Saudi Arabian consulate, and then the body was moved at one point to dispose of it, you don't quite appreciate the nuance of those countries unless you're well versed in them. And I've a friend, a colleague who used to work at the Washington Post in a totally different department, but he said he never even read much of Khashoggi's stuff because he's like, it was so deeply rooted in Middle Eastern politics. And that's not what this friend of mine does. So what this movie does is it gives you that background and it gives you the relevance of it, because for most people before he was murdered, most Americans had never heard of this guy before. And you have to understand the importance of him and why he was, as the title of the film says, a dissident, because of his criticism of the government and his criticism of the Crown Prince and the fact that the Crown Prince didn't like him. The Crown Prince seems to have gotten away with murdering him, and who was involved and who was responsible and who was punished, and if any justice was actually served or if only a modicum of justice was served. This movie itself really is for somebody who's into the international politics. Some of it's very hard to digest because they do throw a lot of it at you, and you do have to reset your brain. And it talks about how some people who are questioning things, how they work with, like, for example, social media, and how involved social media is, in particular in Saudi Arabia, because of the control of state media itself. For most people in America, yeah, there's political Twitter, but there's also people out there taking pictures of their cat and, you know, porn stars putting stuff on OnlyFans and all that kind of stuff. That's much more day-to-day relevant in Saudi Arabia. And part of this movie looks at one of the other people who had worked as a critical person of the Saudi Arabian government and how they worked with Khashoggi and how he was involved. And it actually takes it from several different framing points. So it is a little bit messy of a documentary because they throw so much at you, and it peels it backwards too, because you know that he gets killed because it's such a big news story. But they take the time to peel back what had happened and go through the investigations, and you know what really happened, but you're more or less learning about when people found out about different things and the horrible events that surrounded this and how it impacted his fiancée, who was essentially there when all this stuff was going on. I mean, this is partly a look at his life, partly a look at Saudi Arabian politics, partly a look at the journey of his fiancée who never got any sort of real resolution from this, and also the deal with these other dissidents that he had been working with. So it's interesting, but it is something you got to pay attention to. I'm going to say that ultimately it kind of rocks because there is a lot to digest, but it is an important film and people should see it.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Next movie I want to talk about is Redemption Day. A military hero must travel to Algeria to free his wife, who has been captured by insurgents.
In Morocco, we have found something incredible, and we have been granted access to excavate.
We have to be careful. We are very close to the border.
No!
Don't move!
Please don't shoot! Please don't!
Brad, Kate has been abducted. She's in Algeria.
They were taken to be beheaded.
The gentleman that we are dealing with is crazy.
Yalla!
I need to get into Algeria.
This is out in theaters exclusively this weekend. I think it goes VOD next Tuesday. So if you're not going to go to theaters to see it, or you don't have one that's opened, or you can't find it nearby, if you want to watch it, you can go wait until Tuesday, and then you can watch it on video on demand. This is ultimately, an action flick. It's meant to be a military-driven action thriller about a guy trying to save his wife. And I think that that's a reasonable thing to do. That's a good show. That's appropriate to do, and that makes sense. And in that sense, it does work. Part of the problem with this movie, though, is there's a lot of points where you just kind of find yourself rolling your eyes at things. Like, part of how they end up capturing his wife is she's in Morocco at this dig, because she's like an archaeologist or an anthropologist or something like that. And they happen to be very close to the Algerian border, and they end up crossing it, and then they get captured. And I'm like, how did you mess that one up? I mean, seriously, you had government people with you. You would think that they know where the border, especially if there are Algerian insurgents in the rocks back there and in the caves. So you're watching that, and you do kind of roll your eye at that. And I remember I said this about a horror movie that I reviewed a couple weeks ago. It did suffer from a lower budget than it probably needed. There's an opening sequence in here where it's him in country. I think he's like in Afghanistan, introducing the character, and they have a firefight. And that's a little bit intense, but it takes a long time to get to much more action. A lot of it is just them planning it. There's that movie that came out this summer called The Outpost. That was a big military thriller. And that one has like 45 minutes of just nonstop action. And they really threw some money into that. And they really made that one look good. This one, I don't think had as high of a budget, and it didn't have as much to work with. So, you know, you kind of get that opening action. You got the capture, and then you've got them trying to save her. You know, you got the big raid at the end, which is, you know, sort of what you expect in a movie like this. But the raid just doesn't quite have, you just don't see the money on the screen. You just don't see as much action on the screen. And it's, I think, just suffers from it being very ambitious, but with a much smaller budget than I think it really knew what to do with. And maybe better action staging or stunt staging would have helped. There are some silly things. There's an epilogue that is absurdly silly, in my opinion. But, you know, if you can get to that point, you've seen the movie, you know. So overall, I mean, it's a decent enough film, but I'm going to say it kind of rocks. I'm going to be nice because it fits the bill of just sort of like a throwaway action movie, and it makes its point.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Doctor Who, The Revolution of the Daleks, and Pieces of a Woman. To Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr, and let's jump into more movie reviews. Actually, this one's a television review, and it's one of my favorite shows of all time, so of course I gotta talk about it because, hey, it's me. And that is Doctor Who, The Revolution of the Daleks. Captain Jack Harkness breaks the Doctor out of interstellar jail so she can help him defeat a new Dalek attack on Earth.
How many people in the universe get to meet the Doctor, let alone travel with her? Being with the Doctor, you don't get to choose when it stops. Whether you leave her or she leaves you.
The Doc would really want us to keep an eye on the planet, right?
But how's that possible?
If you don't help, the human race is going down.
You with us?
As of now, you will see new defense drones at work.
Prepare for maximum extermination!
Not you guys.
For many years, a lot of times, the Doctor Who show has done a Christmas special. And they've been doing Christmas specials pretty much ever since they rebooted the series. It was like the Christmas Invasion, and they had one with Santa Claus several years later. They didn't do it at Christmas this year, and they didn't have a Christmas theme. The last several ones that they've done for Christmas as the specials have had a theme. Like I said, they had they had Santa Claus show up in one. So they will oftentimes have some sort of connection to the holiday. Because they didn't have a connection to the holiday, I think they did just a New Year's one. And they often will do that when they don't have a season. British TV is a little weird, where they'll do a season and then they'll maybe wait a year or two or three or five and then do another season. Well, Doctor Who, they did the last season was last year. And then they have the Christmas or holiday special, and that sort of bridges the gap until you have the new season that comes up. So this is the holiday special for this year. It's got its roots in previous episodes with Jodie Whittaker as the Doctor. In one of them, you had Christopher Noth, who, of course, most people know as Mr. Big from the Sex and the City series, a real estate guy, and he's a billionaire, and he's from America, and he was meddling in something that was causing problems in a previous episode. Plus, then they have another previous episode where they bring back the Daleks, because the Daleks never die. And if you don't know what the Daleks are, those little salt shaker looking robots, well, they're cyborgs, because they have inside of them a little squiddly diddly thing that is kind of a helpless creature, but they make them sometimes a little bit more formidable. So if you've watched the previous seasons of the Jodie Whittaker Doctor series, then you've got the background. So some of the characters refer to themselves and you're supposed to know who they are, especially the Mr. Big character. But overall, this one is about somebody in the UK developing essentially these police drones based on the Dalek design. But of course, because they're Daleks and they never go away, something goes wrong. And then they, of course, become murdering psychopathic robots. And that's, of course, what you have happen. And of course, you got to have the Doctor and her companions help stop everything. You know, it works. It's a nice one-off series. That's one of the things I like about the Christmas episodes is they aren't trying to do a character arc necessarily. They're just telling a good old-fashioned Doctor Who story. And, you know, like I said, in the last episode of the last season, she was put in interstellar jail. But this shows how she gets out. And plus, it's neat to see Jack Harkness again. If you don't know who that is, he's a guy who's showed up all the way back, I think in the first year that they rebooted Doctor Who in 2005. And he's an immortal character. He keeps showing up throughout. He was also critical to Torchwood. And so that's brought up a lot of questions of whether the BBC is going to bring back Torchwood or a version of Torchwood to see if it works. And now Torchwood goes all the way back to the mid 2000s where it's a little bit clunky. Things have gotten a little more sophisticated since Torchwood came out. So I'll be curious to see if they do it. And even this Doctor Who episode, the science fiction and the special effects and the look of the show is certainly much, much better than even some of the stuff we saw in the first couple seasons of the reboot. So I gotta say, I enjoyed Doctor Who, The Revolution of the Daleks. You can find it online. It aired on New Year's Day on BBC America, but you can find it on a whole bunch of platforms. You can rent it on like Vudu or Amazon, but I think if you've got BBC America, you can get it through that. You sometimes have to have a cable subscription. If you got AMC Plus through something like the Roku channel, that will work for you as well. So I'm gonna have to say, Doctor Who, The Revolution of the Daleks, totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the next film, which is Pieces of a Woman. Vanessa Kirby and Shia LaBeouf star as a young married couple who lose their baby during a home birth.
She sounds really good.
Hi, baby.
My daughter came into this world for the time that she did.
And I can't bring her back.
60-70% of these cases, we rarely find a satisfactory explanation. Certain things medically we just don't have answers for.
Have you decided to go to the trial?
It's the right thing to do, honey.
Because you say it is.
We need some justice here.
No, you need.
This is one of Netflix's big award pushes. They're pushing it for, you know, best picture, best screenplay, all that. But in particular, they're really pushing for Vanessa Kirby to win best actress. And I mean, it's a deserved push because Vanessa Kirby does do a lot in this movie. I'm just going to start off by saying this is not my kind of movie. I'm not a fan of these movies. I'm not a fan of a movie that just wrings as much emotion out of you as it can, like a damp washcloth. It's just, those are exhausting to watch. And I often find myself, when you see people at their worst, you second guess it and you say, I would never do that. Or I've been in situations like that and I wouldn't act like that. And I didn't like, in particular, the Shia LaBeouf character, I didn't like from the beginning. I thought he was he was what Shia LaBeouf brings to everything now. Sort of that, you know, oh, I got my swagger and I'm really cool, but I'm also macho, but I also am struggling with all of my emotions. So I think he's overwrought and overdone in this movie. Vanessa Kirby grounds it and she does a great job in it. But the other problem with this movie that I had personally is it's about them having this home birth. And look, I know home births happen and I know they do them all the time. And I know that millions of babies are born every year. I know that it's a successful, very trustworthy situation. I would never do it. And we have three kids. And I remember our first child was born and he was sunny side up, which means his face was facing my wife's spine. So he was getting distressed as she was starting to push. As he was coming to the birth canal, the heart rate was lowing, there was distress on the baby. And so they made the decision to go take her in the operating room and, you know, do the C-section, an emergency C-section. I don't know what I would have done if it would have been a home birth. I'm sure it probably would have been taken care of, and I'm sure people who are well-versed in that thing, they've run into situations like this, and they know when to call the ambulance. But having been through a situation where I personally have witnessed how quickly you have to change your birthing plan, I personally wouldn't do it. My wife personally wouldn't do it. And I'm not trying to step on anybody's toes and I'm not trying to cause a problem here. But it is one of those things where I'm like, at least at a hospital, you have everybody ready to go. And the other thing with this is that sometimes things happen that you don't have any control over. And so a whole chunk of this movie is about the stress and the pain and the want to find somebody's fault and to make somebody pay for this. And in reality, sometimes something goes wrong. And it's like any time you go through surgery, it could be the most basic surgery, but you know, sometimes something goes wrong and it's nobody's fault. It's not anybody that you can say that person gave them the wrong medicine or they cut this thing or they didn't. Sometimes things go wrong in a medical situation. And you know, there's these fighting, all this fighting and angst and unpleasant emotion going on with this family about wanting to get some sort of reconciliation for the loss of this child. And I to me, I'm just like, well, at times there's nothing you can do. Plus the characters are kind of jerks sometimes. I'm not talking about Vanessa Kirby's character. She gets a pass on a lot of this. Her character gets a pass on a lot of it because of what she went through. But some of the people in this movie just, they act like jerks. And maybe it's the way they process grief, but I just didn't like it. In this movie, people love it for the performance and they love it for the heart-wrenching emotion. I did not like it. So for me, it totally sucked.
It sucks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about the history of swear words and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring 12-Hour Shift. To Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's continue on with reviews. And I say reviews because this one is another television review. It's a series on Netflix and it's called The History of Swear Words. Nicolas Cage hosts this series, which examines the history and evolution of the most vulgar words in our current society.
Swear words. They're the most popular and alluring taboos we have. But the secrets to their strange power have been shrouded in mystery until now. Join me on a journey through the history, evolution, and cultural impact of swear words.
words don't start out as swear words. They're just words.
Somebody decided at some point that this is a swear word.
Imagine you've been called the worst thing you could be called so often that it doesn't mean anything to you anymore.
There's something innately human about swearing.
I gotta admit, at first I was kind of worried that I wouldn't be able to find a trailer that would be appropriate to play on the radio. Because the trailer literally starts with Nicolas Cage dropping the F-bomb for about 6 seconds. So, I mean, that's what it's about. It's about swear words. First of all, before I actually talk about the content of this, one of the things I noticed when I was watching it is it looks like this has been shot during the pandemic. Because it's all talking heads. It's all interviews. Nicolas Cage is pretty much alone in his host chair. And everybody they interview, what it is it involves him just sort of like giving you the information, and then they kind of tell the story of where these words come from. And you've got these linguists and these etymologists. But then you also have comedians, you know, people like Sarah Silverman, or actors, you know, entertainers that people would recognize. Somebody like Nick Offerman shows up. And it's done by Funny or Die. So of course they have a lot of connections to the comedy world. But everybody's done as a talking head. And I mean, it doesn't look like it's trying to be shot in the pandemic. Whereas you remember when the pandemic started and they had a whole bunch of these special episodes, they did one for Mythic Quest Raven's Banquet on Apple TV. They did one with, Parks and Rec came back and did a reunion where everybody was like on a Zoom call. It wasn't like that. It doesn't look like it's being forced into the pandemic, but it looks like it was something that they were probably able to do with pandemic rules, because there's no people interacting on screen. But with some animation and some cutting, you could actually put together content. And I thought that was a little bit of interesting ingenuity coming out of this production. You know, I think that's kind of a cool little thing. But anyways, about the show itself, it's 6 episodes, they're about 22 minutes each. And each episode is devoted to a specific swear word. And the 6 words are and damn. Now, they don't do all the extra swear words or the multiple swear words like or even stuff that's like not quite a swear word like. They don't cover any of those. They just cover those main swear words. And it's not even like the 7 dirty words that George Carlin has said. You know, it's not even coming off of that. These are just sort of like considered the most incendiary swear words. And then what they do is they have the linguists come in and explain where the root of the word came from and where it first showed up in literature and in writing and in discussions, and then how it evolves over the years and how it started out not as a swear word, but as just a common word, and eventually sort of it getting some level of vulgarity attached to it. And for somebody like me, I find this interesting because there's a part of me that's the nerd that likes to see where the evolution of language went. And I think that that's kind of fascinating, especially, you know, what was considered a swear word in the past, when some of these words were not considered vulgar, and how things change over the years. It's a fascinating look at that. But then there's also the comedians. You know, of course, Sarah Silverman is a master of swearing. A master of swearamonies, so to speak, although that would be probably Nicolas Cage's job. She does a great job, you know, finding ways to make the swear words interesting and fun. And, you know, it's a nice little, this is a lark. This is a cute little show. Maybe not something to watch with the kids unless you really want to teach them how to swear, but everybody should know how to swear. You know, you should swear in front of your kids, because then the kids learn how to swear. I was listening to my son earlier today, downstairs playing Xbox, and I heard him, he's 12, and so he's saying some things that are a little bit blue, and I'm like, at least he knows he sounds like he knows how to swear, so that's a good thing. At least my grandfather taught me how to swear. I spent a summer driving with him, and my grandmother and his brother, my great uncle. They were taking him from like Cleveland to Washington to like a veterans home or something like that. And having my grandfather and his brother talking the whole time, I learned how to swear so well during that trip. I knew how to use words I didn't even realize could be used for adjectives. it was a very eye-opening experience. So this is probably a little more entertaining than that. So I'm going to have to say, I liked it. It was fun. It rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. Today's spotlight is on an independent film that is out now on DVD and Blu-ray, so you can get the physical copy, and that is 12 Hour Shift. This independent film follows a group of nurses in 1999 whose organ selling scheme falls apart one night.
Is this a joke?
You lost thousands of dollars worth of organs.
If I don't bring him a kidney, I'm dead. I can still get you a kidney. You kept all the organs inside.
Cops are coming here.
I'm not leaving till you give me a kidney.
Why would you bring this cousin of yours into this if you knew she would kill people?
I sometimes have too much faith in humanity.
This is directed by Brie Grant. Now, a lot of people don't remember who she was. She had a little blip there in the mid-2000s, a little bit farther than that, where she got some notice as an actor. She was in Heroes. She was the speedster in Heroes. She was in one of those movies. I think it was the one with Mark Wahlberg, Max Payne. Like I said, she was in Heroes. She was in the Halloween 2 sequel, the crappy one by Rob Zombie. And she showed up in Dexter and a couple other things. And she does show up and stuff as an actress, but she's been trying to do more directing. And she's did one about 7 or 8 years ago, which was sort of like a post-apocalyptic girlfriend road trip movie. And this one, I think, is her sophomore effort. I give her credit because she's got a real edge to her. She does not go nicey-nice with these movies. And there's some interesting stuff with this movie that I do like. In particular, Angela Bettis plays the main character. She's this overworked nurse in the 90s who is on pain pills, and she's selling organs. She takes organs out of a body that's going to be ended up getting cremated that nobody's claiming, and she sells them to her cousin, who then takes them to a trafficker. But of course, at one point, they misplace the organs, and that causes this chain of events that goes down. It's dark and it's creepy, and I like the fact that it has that dark side to it. In some ways, though, it's a little bit too dark. In the point that I don't like any of the characters, they all have problems, and I can get behind a character that has some problems, but I mean, some of them, I mean, really awful people, some real dirtbags of humans, and there's no one that you actually like. And it's also kind of terrifying to wonder if you've ever been in a hospital or a loved one has ever been in a hospital and have run into these nurses who are borderline psychopath. Hopefully our healthcare workers are a little more put together than what you have in this movie, but it's an interesting, edgy, violent, dark comedy. And if you like that sort of thing, that sort of independent-minded approach, you'll probably like this one. Like I said, it maybe was just a little bit too dark for me. And that's saying a lot. I like dark stuff. So I'm going to say it kind of rocks, at least.
It kind of rocks.
Also out this week, we've got Love and Monsters, a re-release of Savage Streets, one of the exploitation movies that Linda Blair did after her Exorcist days. And then The Train Special Edition from the 60s, which I think stars Burt Lancaster in it. And that's it. Those are the big ones for this week. It was a little bit slow with the DVDs and Blu-rays this week because everything came out right before Christmas, but it's going to ramp up again pretty soon. Anyways, that's it for this week. I need to go. When I come back next week, I'm going to be talking about The Marksman and WandaVision. Until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.